Sanhedrin Daf Chof discusses the rights of a king to impose upon his subjects. There's one opinion in the Gemara that the king's rights are restricted, but the Rambam follows the opinion in the Gemara that the king has very, very broad rights to impose upon his subjects. He's allowed to take them to be officers in his army. He can draft them. He can take away their property, etc. And based on this, the Zohar, followed by Tosfos, has a question based on some incidents that are recorded in Nevi'im. Sefer Melachim, we learn about a person whose name was Navos. Navos had a vineyard that was near Shomron, the capital of the ten tribes. And the king of the ten tribes at that time was named Achav, and Achav wanted Navos's vineyard. And after much scheming and plotting, following Navos's refusal to give him the vineyard, he ended up having Navos falsely accused and put to death, and then he swooped in and took away the vineyard. Now, the Zohar asks, if the Melech, if the king has the right to confiscate people's property, then why was Achav punished for putting Navos to death? This was also Tosfos' question. Why was Achav punished for putting Navos to death? After all, Achav had the right to take away Navos' vineyard. When Navos refused to give Achav the vineyard, so he was essentially rebelling against the king. He was a morid. He was essentially not listening to what the king told him. And therefore, why was Achav punished for taking Navos' vineyard? So this question really has two independent dimensions. The first dimension is, why was Achav punished for taking the vineyard? That's the dimension which the Zohar focuses on and which Tosfos focuses on. The second dimension is, why was Achav punished for killing Navos? And that's a dimension that's focused on by the Chidushi Haran. I want to treat these two dimensions separately because they take diametrically opposite views about the nature of the Isser of Mori B'Malchus, of rebelling against a king. And the Zohar answers its question by saying that Achav was not punished for taking away Navos' vineyard. By taking the vineyard, he was acting fully within his rights as a melech. However, says the Zohar, what Achav was punished for was killing Navos. He need not have gone through that elaborate scheme and falsely accusing Navos of what he was accused of, then murdering him in order to take away his vineyard. He should have simply utilized the melech's prerogative to use force to confiscate the property of his subjects. For killing Navos, he was liable to punishment. That is a Zohar's answer. Now, for this answers the first part of the question about why Achav was held liable for taking away the vineyard. The answer is, he wasn't liable for taking away the vineyard, he was liable for killing Navos. The second half of the question, the one that's expressed by the Chidushi Haran, though, is not really answered satisfactorily by this answer, because the Chidushi Haran claims that Navos was a Mori B'Malchus. He was in rebellion against his king by refusing to give him the vineyard. And anyone who rebels against the king is deserving of the death penalty. The Gemara says this later on in the Masechta. Anyone who's a Mori B'Malchus is Chayiv Misa. In Cain, this being the case, asks Haran, so Achav shouldn't have been liable neither for taking away the vineyard nor for putting Navos to death. So I just want to take a step back and analyze for a moment what the prohibition is of Morid B'Malchus. The paradigmatic case of Morid B'Malchus, the paradigmatic example are Avshalom and Adon Yahu. Avshalom and Adon Yahu, during the lifetime of David HaMelech, plotted to and indeed succeeded in usurping the monarchy for some amount of time. And that's the paradigmatic Morid B'Malchus, a person who wants to replace the king with himself and takes action, and perhaps even succeeds in that action to do so. So that's the Morid B'Malchus. It's a rebellion against the king, it's a rebellion against the kingdom, it's a rebellion against the government. The person himself usurps the monarchy. Now, there's a second category of Morid B'Malchus, and that category is somebody who plots to undermine the government, or who in other ways undermines the authority of the king. And this can be understood in a narrow sense, meaning a person who's a subversive, who plans or who plots to overthrow or undermine the government, is a Morid B'Malchus. A And there's a third level, which is a more diffuse undermining of the king's authority, or perhaps it doesn't even undermine the king's authority at all, and is melechayev misa for other reasons, and that is the person who disobeys a command by the king when the king has the right to give him that command. On the one hand, this is somewhat undermining the king's authority, because one who disobeys the king is setting, you know, a bad precedent in terms of letting other people disobey later on, in terms of diminishing the king's authority. But perhaps it's not, you know, the reason he's punished, if he is punished for disobeying the king, is not because of the undermining the authority, but simply because anyone who disobeys the king's command is considered a morid, he's considered in rebellion. The king has, you know, the king commands him, the king has a right to command him. If he disobeys the command, then he's a rebel. So these are three pshatim in morid b'malchus: somebody who plots to seize the throne, somebody who plots to overthrow the government, and somebody who simply disobeys the king. Now, if we look at what Navos did on the scale of these three things, Navos clearly was not planning to seize, to usurp the throne. Navos was also not planning to overthrow the government. Navos's only crime was disobeying the king's command. So hence, we may want to make the following inference. According to the Zohar and according to Tosfos, who feel that Navos' death was unjustified, that Navos was not in Mori the Malchus, and who are only troubled by Achav's seizure of Navos' vineyard, clearly the definition of Mori the Malchus is more narrow. It is limited to one who plots to usurp the throne or to overthrow the government. However, the Chidushi Haran, who believes that Navos was actually considered a Morib Malchus, that Achav should not have been liable under ordinary laws of the monarchy, he should not have been liable for seizing the vineyard nor for killing Navos, clearly holds a very expanded definition of Morib Malchus, namely that anyone who disobeys the command of the king is considered in rebellion and is liable to capital punishment. This machlokis between Tosfos and the Ran seems to parallel a machlokis between two opinions of Tosfos in Kedushin. The Gemara in Kedushin mentions that Uriah HaChiti, who was one of the soldiers in David HaMelech's army, was considered a Morid B'Malchus, and therefore David HaMelech was justified in killing him. So what are the two opinions in Tosfos? One opinion says that Uriah HaChiti was a Morid B'Malchus because he gave, in front of David, he called Yoav, David's general, his master. That was something which was undermining the government. To call somebody else my master in front of the king is essentially the first step or an indication of desire for supplanting the king. And therefore, Uriah HaChiti, by calling his general my master in front of the king, was clearly, you know, indicating very severe disrespect, which bordered upon a disrespect that was part and parcel of a plot or a conspiracy to supplant the present government. And therefore, says Tosfos, he was Chayav Misa. This is the more limited view of what Morib B'Malchus is. The second view that Tosfos presents is that Uriah HaChiti was liable not only for calling Yoav his master, perhaps he was not liable for that because that's insufficient evidence of desire to supplant the government. However, says Tosfos, Uriah HaChiti was liable for disobeying David HaMelech's command to return to the battlefront. David HaMelech told Uriah, go back to the battlefront, and Uriah instead spent the night at home. So David HaMelech has a right, this was part of the Melech's right to draft soldiers. He's allowed to command soldiers to go to the battlefront. This soldier didn't listen to the command. He stayed home for an extra night. Therefore, he's liable for Morib B'Malchus because of his disobedience to the king's command. And this, I believe, parallels the Chidushi Haran's pshat that Navos too was considered a Morib B'Malchus for disobeying the command of his king, of Achav HaMelech. So again, so far, we've only encountered one of the seven or eight answers that are offered by Rishonim for why Achav was liable for seizing Navos' vineyard, and that's what the Zohar answered, that he wasn't liable for seizure of the vineyard, he was liable instead for killing Navos. But obviously, according to the Chidushi Haran, according to all those who hold of a broader definition of Morib B'Malchus, this answer is insufficient, because Achav should have been liable neither for seizing the vineyard nor for killing Navos, who was a Morib B'Malchus. So therefore, there's a number of other answers that are presented by the Rishonim. I just want to mention two of them, which are subject to important machlokos. The first is that the Rambam writes that a king's right to seize property extends only in wartime. It does not extend in times of peace. In other words, if a melech wants to seize a property for his own use, or for the use of his servants, or even if he simply wants to make a permanent seizure of the property, he's not entitled to do so. All that he's entitled to do so, says the Rambam, is that if his army is traveling to the battlefront, and they need to take a direct route, they're entitled to cut across people's fields and even to destroy people's fences and uproot their plants in order to proceed most directly and most swiftly to fight where they need to fight. Otherwise, if not to make room for his army, the king is not entitled to seize property. And this answer is expanded on a little bit by the Chiddush Aran, who says it's not only in times of battle, but it certainly is only in times of need. And certainly the king has no right to confiscate property permanently. And Tosfos says something which is similar. However, there are many Rishonim who say, no, that really a king has a right to seize property both in times of battle and not in times of battle, both transiently and permanently. So this is one important machlokas. Second important machlokas is as follows. Tosfos responds that Achav was not a bona fide king because he was not appointed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He was like a self-appointed king. And the Chiddush Aran says then, no, that Achav had the din of a king who was appointed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, we know that Achav was not directly appointed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but at the same time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu did guarantee that the Jewish kingdom would split and that there would be an independent king of the 10 tribes. Achav was that independent king. So even though, says Tosfos says, that the fact that he wasn't directly appointed by a prophet, or he or his ancestors were not directly appointed by a prophet, means that he's not a king al pi hadibur, he's not appointed king by God, he's self-appointed or appointed by the people. However, the Chiddush Aran says that once God guaranteed that there would be an independent king of the 10 tribes, any king whom the 10 tribes appoint has a din of a king who was appointed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So these are three important machlokos. Number one, the definition of Borei B'Malchus, is it only someone who seeks to supplant the government, or even somebody who disobeys the king's command? Number two, whether the right of the king to seize property is only temporarily and during wartime, or whether it's even permanent seizure and at any time? And number three, whether a king who sort of, you know, was prophesied that he would be king but was not directly appointed, has a din of a melech who was appointed by God, or only the din of a melech who was appointed by the people.